basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. I keep it so fresh on the microphone. I like no interruption when the game is on. I like slam dunk to take me to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like to pick and roll. I like to give and go. And it's basketball. Bow wow, let's go.
The title track from the new movie Space Jam, starring LeBron James. No. This is a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, 10 o'clock, we're going to do Swap Meet. It's Antiques Roadshow for Chicago. Jack Silverstein is in studio now. We'll be talking with him about his book about the 96 Bulls. But do you have a piece of memorabilia that you hang on to, that is with you at all times? That you're like, oh, this is a piece of Chicago memorabilia that I just can't get rid of.
Man, you know, my favorite piece of memorabilia growing up, actually, this is going to sound weird, but it was a Miami Dolphins wristband because my grandfather's Bears season tickets were on the visitor side, so we would go down at halftime and after the game and stand by the tunnel where, you know, players would go out, and somebody on the Fins
just threw it out.
Wristband, you know, takes it off and tosses it to it, and I was like, oh my God, a wristband. I felt kind of crummy, like, sort of favoring this Dolphins wristband.
Yeah, but it's aqua.
But it came
it's like
off of someone.
Yeah, it's nice. Okay, so the Golden State Warriors are right now leading at halftime by 8 over the Oklahoma City Thunder in Game 5. They're down 3-1 in the Western Conference Finals. A Western Conference Finals that was somewhat predetermined because, well, the Golden State Warriors were predetermined to be the best team that ever played. If you watched SportsCenter maybe a month ago, all you saw was people on the broadcast talking about regular season records and the 96 Bulls.
It's true.
And it seemed over and over that they're like, well, I don't know if the Bulls could hold. And then Charles Barkley got involved and everybody talked like this was a real argument. Well,
people were on some nonsense.
I don't remember the Bulls, the 96 Bulls going down 3-1 to I don't know who they play in the they play Orlando in the
they swept Orlando.
They swept Orlando, a team that everyone's like, oh, watch out for Shaquille O'Neal. They went, nah, get out of here.
They beat Orlando down bad.
In studio with me right now, this is an appropriate night to talk about this. A new book from Jack Silverstein, a Chicago journalist who also is our sort of I would formalize it our his sports historian here on the download on WGN. The book is called How the Goat Was Built: 6 Life Lessons from the 1996. Chicago Bulls. Jack, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
So yeah, let's talk about this. I mean, there has been, before we get into the book, which is fascinating, and the how you sort of came about putting together the 6 life lessons based on the 96 Bulls, there was a lot of talk about this Golden State Warriors team chasing and possibly eclipsing the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll get it right out front. I love this Warriors team. This was like my de facto other team. Because it was actually easier. I don't have cable, but for some reason TNT lets you watch games for free on your computer. I don't know why they do that. I don't know what the
business model is
on that one. But yeah, I watched a ton of Golden State games. They're so much fun. I have nothing against Golden State. People were asking me all season, do you not want them to break the record? I'm not rooting for them to break the record, but I'm not rooting against them because they're a good time.
Right.
They're a fun team to watch. But no, I never thought that they were better than the Bulls or could defeat the Bulls. They just have size issues, as we're seeing this year.
Well, I mean, obviously the regular season records were made to be broken.
Sure.
We'll just start there. But let's talk about the book. Where'd you come up with the idea to not just sort of piece together the history of the 96 Bulls? You know, the Bulls have been well documented.
Right.
But to sort of glean life lessons from them.
It started because I was always really fascinated by the 28-month period between the 93 finals when we wrapped up against Phoenix and the 95-96 preseason when we started the road, you know, to the 72 wins. And I always thought that that period was just like a really cool, unique sports historical period where we rebuilt a championship team. We took one three-peat team and we turned it into a totally different three-peat team. Obviously, we kept the two most important players and we kept the head coach. So some people are like, it's not that different. But you're talking about 10, 11, you know, with the injured roster, 12 other guys, totally different in the span of two seasons, and to rebuild everybody and create a whole different style of play. I mean, there were plenty of similarities between the first three-peat and the second one, but there were a lot of differences as well. And that just always was, I was just always amazed by that when people would dog Jerry Krause and be like, I don't know, did you watch what he was doing?
Well, that's true, because you always say that people always refer to the Bulls as winning six championships, right. One team, the 90s Bulls. But they were two different squads.
Two different teams.
Like you said, I mean, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Phil Jackson notwithstanding. But the concept that they were two different dynasties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One thing that Jordan talked about a lot, and he talked about it at the time, and he speaks about it later, is the drive that he always had to get a ring for the new guys. So in 92, there was only one new guy, Bobby Hansen. In 93, after they won the title, in his post-game interview, he was like, yeah, this is for Ed Neely and Corey Williams. Like, why are you talking about these guys? But Michael would find any little bit of motivation,
right.
And that was one of them. So in 96, when you had this whole new team, nobody had won a title with the Bulls. Obviously, Rodman and James Edwards, and then later in the season when they acquired John Sally, those three guys had won titles. But the main guys, Harper hadn't, Kukoc, Luke Longley, Steve Kerr. I mean, these guys came from like sort of like busted teams, and all of a sudden they're on this all-time great, and it was Michael and Scotty and Phil teaching everyone how to keep the energy up, how to keep the madness up, how to go out and win the second of a back-to-back and not take a night off. I mean, one of my favorite Jordan stats is that he played from when he came back from baseball until when he retired in 98. He played every regular season game.
Wow.
He played every playoff game. He played every preseason game until the sixth preseason game of 1998, which allegedly he missed with an ingrown toenail. It came after he was the only star. Well, Kukoc was there, but Scotty and Dennis missed the trip to Paris when the Bulls went out and played in the McDonald's whatever, you know, against Europe's finest. And Jordan went out there and rocked it, so he came back ingrown toenail. Okay, fine.
Sure.
He missed one game in 3.5 years, a preseason game.
That's unheard of.
300, I think the number is 357 out of 358.
I mean, LeBron
games.
James comes close, but you still see him suited up for a week, you know, on the sideline. Derrick Rose, obviously, with all his troubles. I mean, even Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant have missed extreme time. There's not an NBA star in the game right now who doesn't sit out for a week or two during a regular season.
But even look, yeah, I mean, even look at the Spurs, and that's like written into the coding of how that team works, that they know that Popovich is going to give them a night here or there, you know, like almost like in baseball,
right.
You know, we're going to give you a night off, which isn't something that happened in basketball, and it didn't happen with Jordan. And Jordan, I mean, we're talking about a guy, he turned 32 in February of 95, right before he came back. So this is 32, 33, 34, 35-year-old who's playing those games.
We're talking with Jack Silverstein, How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's take a break and we come back. Let's start at the beginning with Michael Jordan and the Chicago White Sox. Really interesting stories about him and why he left basketball, playing baseball, and returning. Jack's my guest here on The Download. Stay with us.
For the three-peat, Chicago's in the house. Peace. Dribble it up, dribble it up, say what? Chicago Bulls, dribble it up, dribble it up. What? Here come the Bulls, dribble it up, dribble it up. Say what? Chicago Bulls, dribble it up. Yeah, here come the Bulls.
There you go. It's Download here on WGN Radio. Jack Silverstein, our our OG sports historian. He's been with us since the beginning of the show. He just wrote a book. It's called How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. And in this book, it's not just, you know, just stats and hey, you remember Scottie Pippen? You remember Dennis Rodman? You really do break down, you know, what you can learn from this team, not just about basketball, but about life. Let's start at the beginning where you start, which is when Michael Jordan goes to play baseball.
Yeah.
And the one thing I find interesting is that, you know, it's still to this day is dogged by conspiracy theories and others that he was kicked out of basketball because he had a gambling problem. He was gambling on the NBA, maybe even gambling on his own games. That's never been proven, and you set out in this book at the beginning to sort of set out the ultimate conspiracy theory that all that's bull.
Yeah, my feeling is that if there were a suspension, if he were actually kicked out of the league for a year or for 18 months or whatever it was, we'd know about it by now. I just don't see that as possible. Sam Smith made a really good point on the Jordan 30 for 30 documentary, you know, that you can't keep a secret in the NBA.
Right.
If this had happened, like,
gee, Joe Noah, Noah's not, I mean, they'd go back and it's already out.
Right.
Yeah.
That would have made your career. there was a journalist or a couple journalists who told Ron Shelton, who made that 30 for 30 Jordan Rides the Bus, that he was, they were like, we would have won the Pulitzer. Like, we looked for everything. And I think it's really sexy and fun to think about, oh my God, he was secretly suspended. But I don't see the proof. I think in this case, it's actually probably just like the boring truth. Jordan was talking about wanting to retire as early as 91. It was documented. He was telling teammates. I mean, it's in the Jordan rules before anyone really, realized what that even was going to lead to. Obviously, nobody knew.
And they thought maybe he was joking around a little bit. You know, he says, well, I'm not going to be here next year. You'll be sorry when I'm gone kind of stuff. He was doing that a lot with reporters and teammates, things like that.
And then you remember the Johnny Kilroy commercials?
Yeah, that was strange. And you point that out in the book that, you know, why would Michael Jordan, if he was on a lifetime ban or a ban for gambling or a suspension, be able to not only do it in jest, but why would there be commercial then, like the NBA would let him talk about it in sort of a funny way on a commercial?
You know? Right. The guise of the Johnny Kilroy commercials was that Michael had faked his retirement, whatever that means. It's not like faking your death. You're either retired or you're not. So faked his retirement in order to play semi-pro basketball under various aliases, most prominent being Johnny Kilroy, also Motorboat Jones is another one of my favorites. And it's incredible. They got all these like NBA stars to be in the commercials talking about fake Jordan. You know, oh, he showed up in Ames, Iowa and scored 60 in 12 minutes or, you know, whatever. But he talks about in the commercials, they're not going to let, you know, Michael Jordan's not going to let anything stand in his way from doing what he wants to do. It's like teasing this idea of gambling or of being suspended.
Or a suspension, right?
Yeah, exactly. Why would you do that? I mean, that would be so reckless. I just don't buy it. I think that everything is actually on the level.
Well, you know, you talk about baseball, which, and I really appreciated you breaking down the stats for his time in the minor leagues, because, you know, it's sort of the wives' tale or the main storyline is he failed. You know, that he wasn't a good player. You always say 202. You know, you see that there was the famous Sports Illustrated Air Jordan, ERR.
Right.
But you break down the numbers and say he actually wasn't that bad of a baseball player and he was getting better.
First of all, 202, it's not like, oh gosh, he hit 202. Yeah. It's not like if Barry Bonds went out for a season.
Giancarlo Stanton's hitting 202 right about now.
I mean, Jordan hit let's put it the other way. Jordan hit 202. He was 31 years old. He hadn't played ball since 18. He's going to double A. Okay?
Real pitchers.
These are like no clowns. Right. I mean, these are all guys. These are like kids who are trying to get into the bigs and who do get into the bigs. And he hit 202. His average was on the rise. When he went to the Arizona Fall League, he was teammates with Nomar Garciaparra the year before Nomar was called up. And Nomar was coming off a celebrated high school and college career. He was at Georgia
Star,
Tech.
Right.
He was drafted by the Brewers out of high school. Jordan hit 252. I mean, this is no joke. Jordan was projected to be a White Sox like fifth outfielder by 1996.
And what happened? So, and you kind of point to the strike. And
yeah.
there was a lot of kind of posturing using Michael Jordan as a political pawn, if you will, for both labor and owners.
Right. So both sides really wanted to use Jordan. On the labor side, you've got them saying, or hypothetically saying, well, we're going to strike and Jordan's going to be with us and you're not going to get that money. And, you know, obviously on the owner side, they're going to say, go ahead. We don't care. We've got Michael Jordan. We'll fill the stands.
He'll be a replacement player.
He'll be a replacement player. Exactly. And Jordan didn't want any part of that. What I point out in the book and what I've always thought was interesting is that we've got this conspiracy theory culture, especially in the NBA. Obviously, you've got this Jordan suspension retirement stuff. You've got real things like Tim Donaghy and, you know, the official
referees,
scandals.
Right.
Then you've got things like Patrick Ewing winning the Knicks, winning the 85 lottery, all that stuff.
Bulls and Derrick Rose, but
Bulls
I
and
digress.
Derrick Rose. All right. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was as competitive in his own way as Jordan. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was paying Michael Jordan his basketball salary to play minor league baseball, $4 million a year. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was the owner credited most popularly as taking the hardest line against the players. Why isn't it a conspiracy? I'm not saying this is true. Why isn't it a discussed conspiracy theory that Jerry Reinsdorf was motivated to turn the screws on the players' union to get his best asset back in the place where he was most valuable?
So you're saying that the whole Major League Baseball strike happened so Jerry Reinsdorf could get Michael Jordan back in the NBA?
I by no means would say
quote,
that.
Quote, unquote. Love it. That's a good. See, we should stick on that conspiracy
theory.
A much better conspiracy theory than he's out of the league for gambling. That's
I'm just saying, like, why aren't people talking about that? That seems so obvious to me.
Wow. The book is called How the Goat Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's take a break for the news. When we come back, let's go through putting this team together, this 96 team together. Because Jordan came back the year before. We all know number 45. But in that offseason between the 95 team and the 96, the 95-96 team, a lot of things happened that shifted, you know, turned this team from a, what were they, a 4 or 5 seed? Or
In 95, they were a 5 seed.
A 5 seed to the best team of all
time. A 6 seed, I'm sorry. A 6.
They were 6 seed. Yeah, right.
They were slipping. They were 3 games above 500 when Jordan came back.
There you go. So we'll talk with Jack Silverstein coming up here after the news. Stay with us.
There's no doubt, I said Chicago. We got the Bulls in the house, so come on Bulls fans, let me hear you make noise. Get up and jump, scream, shout for our boys, Michael.
That's corny.
Jordan picks up the pace, I said Scotty. Pippen dunks in your face, and you can bet that Dennis pulls down the boards. We got 3.
There's a lot of passion coming out of this.
Yo, they made so many weird parody bull songs.
I know, and Pete's got them all.
Do you remember, you guys remember in 96, somebody, I remember it was always on the radio, somebody made a parody of Joan Osborne's What If One of Us, What If God Was One of Us, and
was it
Dennis Rodman is the best.
What if Dennis Rodman's the best?
That's what it sounded like.
Oh my gosh. In studio, Jack Silverstein. He's the author of How the Goat Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. We're talking the best that ever was, the 96 Bulls. We're talking about Michael Jordan and his time in baseball, but he came back, he did the I'm back, that was the year before, 45 to 23, the whole bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then the offseason came, and what did the Bulls have at that point? They had Ron Harper, they had Luke Longley, Tony Kukoc, Scottie Pippen. They had a lot of the players that were the nucleus of the 96 team already in place.
Yeah, they had almost everybody. Remember, they traded Will Perdue for Dennis Rodman. That was a one-to-one trade.
That was the thing that they did right before the season started. They did that in the summertime where they were like,
they did it in October.
Yeah.
They did it right before the preseason. The day that the day that Phil Jackson and Jerry Krause were meeting with Dennis Rodman at the Birdo Center, the Tribune ran an interview, a Q&A between Sam Smith and Phil Jackson, where Phil said, we're a power player away. We're one guy away from being a 60-win team.
At this point, Dennis Rodman represents the Bad Boys of Detroit. He had gone to San Antonio. He had taken on a new persona.
Right.
Like, he had left Detroit where he was just an obnoxious, just really irritating but great power forward skinny kid who had run in with the Bulls. He had thrown Scottie Pippen into the hoop. He was just a nasty guy.
Yeah.
He changed a little bit. He went down to San Antonio, changed his hairstyle. He started doing Pizza Hut commercials. He became like a folk icon.
Dennis felt underpaid, and he felt like his best skills were not marketable. Rebounding and defense and hustle and diving out of bounds for loose balls and all of those things. And even though he had had success, he'd won 2 rings with Detroit, he'd been defensive player of the year, he'd been an all-star, he felt like there was no way that he could earn what he considered to be a suitable salary. He wasn't going to get, quote, market value, because there was no market for what he did. And so he turned himself into something that was marketable,
brand, right?
Into a brand off the court. And that's how ultimately he was going to get paid.
So bringing him to Chicago is obviously, in retrospect, in hindsight, a bold and tremendous move. But I could assume at the time, the Michael Jordans, the Scottie Pippins, the players who played against Dennis Rodman, who was a pretty nasty, dirty player, what was their thought? I mean, did they accept him, the idea of Dennis Rodman coming to the Bulls with open arms?
They had 2 thoughts, and I think that the first was, if he helps us win, let's do it. They had been dismantled under the boards by Horace Grant and Shaquille O'Neal in the playoffs against Orlando in 95. And so they knew that they had to find somebody. And the reason that they were able to get Dennis was because he had fallen so far out of favor with San Antonio.
He
took his shoes off and all that stuff with Madonna and everything. He just didn't really fit in there, and they didn't really jive with him. And they were able to trade Will Perdue straight up. I mean, it remained – I mean, just think about that. Think about that. A career backup center was traded straight up. Nobody else, no cash, no draft picks, nothing else for a Hall of Fame forward. I mean, it's unprecedented.
They just wanted him out of San Antonio.
They wanted him out of San Antonio.
It's too much of a headache trouble, which he was a headache and he was trouble. Talk about behind the scenes, yeah. Scottie Pippen,
yeah.
Phil Jackson. I mean, Michael Jordan I can see being like, hey, what it takes to win, we're going to win. Talk about what was happening behind the scenes to get Dennis in the Birdo Center.
Yeah, so the Bulls, right after that 95 series, they made a list of seven power forwards that they were going to pursue. And the list, as far as I've been able to find, has not been made public. But we've got little bits and pieces of it. Phil Jackson's number one was Derek Coleman from the Nets, all-star with the Nets. Michael Jordan's number one was Jason Williams, Derek Coleman's teammate with the Nets, who Michael went to a New York nightclub in June of 95 to personally recruit Jason Williams and told him, listen, all you got to do is like rebound and maybe score some putbacks and we'll start winning rings. So he was on there. They knew they couldn't get Charles Barkley, Larry Johnson. They had tried to get Sean Kemp the year before.
By trading Pippen.
And then the Rodman thing came up. They had a head of scouting. It's called advanced scouting. When you're in the playoffs, you look at the teams who are coming up ahead, because then when you wrap your series, you might have to play them in 2 or 3 days. So you have the scout, the assistant to the general manager, and he became enamored with Rodman when he was scouting them when Rodman was on the Pistons. And so he stayed in Jerry Krause's ear. We got to get Rodman. And Krause had always said, no, he's not our – he had this phrase, not our kind of person. And Dennis Rodman was always high on that list. He's not our kind of person. OOP, our kind of person.
So behind closed doors, what did Phil Jackson have to do? I mean, there's a meeting.
Yeah.
And what did they have to do to – when they bring all of them together – with Dennis Rodman in the room.
So there was a labor stoppage that summer, and teams were not allowed to do any official business until like end of September. And because of that, Jerry Krause had a lot of time to like interview everybody who had ever known Dennis Rodman. And what he became convinced of was that Dennis was not a cultural fit in San Antonio, but that he could fit in with Phil Jackson because Phil was that weird dude. He'd written, you know, he was known even as a player. He wrote that book, Maverick. I mean, he was known as like this out there dude. Phil said when he came back to the NBA, like he was like, oh, I got to like cut my beard and stop showing and up to interviews and hats with feathers.
And the idea that the city of Chicago is going to be much more culturally open to someone like Dennis Rodman as opposed to San Antonio.
And that you're going to come out and win. And that, you know, you're going to have Jordan to keep people in line. So Pippen and Jordan were concerned. And Jordan even went on the record and he said, you know what, he's my teammate. I love him. And like, you know, I love him in that respect. But I still have a lot of bruises. I still have scratches. And Rodman actually said the same thing. Rodman, right after he came, he said, you know, it's so weird. I like playing with Michael and Scottie, but every so often I have this instinct to just like throw him into the backboard. Like he said that on the record. So there was a certain level of tension, but everybody knew that the element that Rodman brought to that team was fundamentally different than any other power forward, any other small forward, anybody else who was going to bang with all these guys. He was a rebounding champ. He was first team all D. The Bulls had 3 of the 5 first team all defense in 96. I mean, they're winning.
You know, obviously you heard that there was tension, but the bigger tension had to be between Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman.
There was, and they didn't get along, but they didn't need to get along. Dennis came in, and Steve Kerr has this great quote in Roland Lazenby's biography of Michael Jordan, that Dennis was subservient to Jordan, and that he gave everybody sort of the same respect, but there was this air of Jordan's the best, and I don't want to disrupt like Jordan's, you know, this box around him, his aura or something. And Jordan and Pippen at that point had such a relationship where they were the top of this power structure that Dennis didn't mess with Scottie either.
Right.
They were all kind of, you know, there was this clear hierarchy. It was
what I remember
really
about the team
dynamic.
Was that Dennis Rodman, at the beginning at least, it probably ended or is different towards the end, but at the beginning he kept his distance. Like he was a little bit aloof. He was a great player and he played, but he was always on a different part of the bench. He was, you know, maybe a different kind of warm up. He was a fan favorite because he changed his hair and he'd do the whole thing, but right. He didn't seem to be like walking side by side with Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan when they would go back to the bench, that kind of thing.
He wasn't, and he's talked openly about that he didn't have conversations with these guys. Phil Jackson was always looking for ways to bring Dennis into the fold. He told the team at the beginning, "We're getting Dennis. There's going to be different rules for him. I'm not going to freak out if he's going to be late to practice because he's going to be late to practice. We're going to handle that with fines. We're not going to talk much about it." There was one point where Phil, everyone was starting to get frustrated with Dennis around 97 and into 98. And Phil at one point pitched to Dennis, you know, maybe we'll do this activity as a team where we'll make this gauntlet. And we'll give them all like rubber bats kind of, you know, like foam bats. And we'll have you run through it, and everyone will get to hit you, and they'll get to let out some of their frustration. And Dennis was, like, freaked out about it. And, like, really, because he was, like, a really shy guy. John Sally said that when they met in college at different collegiate tournaments, that Rodman would stay in his hotel room with the TV all the way up under the covers in bed. And John Sally, you know, such an affable guy, right, would say, "Hey, you want to come out? You want to meet these guys? We're partying, beach, whatever." Dennis would stay under. That whole thing of him coming out and him going to Crowbar and him Madonna and everything like that.
He was the anti-hero, man. Yeah. He became something that we didn't expect from this Bulls team. It was Jordan and Pippen, and it was Pippen was a bad boy in the way that he had off-the-court problems. But you really felt like he connected with a Chicago Bulls fan and made it much more culturally, I hate to say it like this, culturally cool to like the Bulls because of Dennis Rodman.
Dennis brought such another element. Do you remember this? I had all four, not that you'd remember that I had these, but I had all four of these McDonald's special cups. They were like the supersized cups, and they had a picture of Rodman. They were four different ones. And then if you put cold liquid in it, it would change the hair color. I mean,
so dumb. And then they had the Gapers blocked, or the Gapers delays that were on the Kennedy because they were doing the billboard with his head. He became a cultural icon here, to which I would say that not too many athletes get to that point. I mean, Michael Jordan for his skills and Scottie Pippen, but I had never seen. They were doing national reports on how Chicago fell in love with Dennis Rodman. He was a big part of what happened.
He was huge, and he showed up, and all of a sudden, the whole team changed. It was twisted on its head. There was a third person to look at and to carry the attention and to carry the media's attention, and he was also so different. I interviewed the photographer who did the photo for the billboard, for the Rodman billboard. And he's the same photographer who did the famous Jordan, Peyton, Andre Dawson in tuxedos, that thing. Yeah. And he did a ton of Jordan stuff. He said that Jordan would show up to a photo shoot about 30 minutes late, and he would demand that there would be a T-bone steak, a pound of M&Ms, and like six Gatorades. And he would like knock it all out. And then he would tell the guy, he would be like, "You're a professional, right?" And the photographer would say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "I'm a professional too. And when I shoot the basketball, it goes in. I expect you to take these photos and knock them out. I'm giving you 10 shots and you get them in 10. He said Rodman was the opposite. He said Rodman showed up an hour early with two buckets of KFC and asked if he could just chill. And he had a suit coat on for the shoot. And they were shooting him, and they're going, it's not quite right. And somebody said, "Well, what about sleeveless?" And they ripped the sleeves. That's why there's those jagged edges on that famous billboard. They just tore the sleeves off the sport coat.
So interesting. We can talk about this all night. Jack Silverstein's here. How the GOAT was built. Six life lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. And then let's quick go through the six lessons that you learned from this team. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Jack Silverstein's in studio with me. We're talking about his new book, How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's do a quick word association.
Okay,
you ready?
Yeah.
Judd Buchler.
Ears.
Okay. Bill Wennington.
Canada.
Okay. Ron Harper.
Peg leg.
Randy Brown.
Zero. His original number.
Steve Kerr.
Three.
Yeah.
Okay, so that leaves who's left. I mean, I guess we do Buddha Edwards.
Tall.
John Sally.
Tall and funny.
And then the last three, I guess, are Luke Longley.
Yeah. Surfing.
Surfing. Okay, then you got Dennis Rodman.
Hair.
Scottie Pippen.
Gun. Oh, God, I can't believe I just said that. That feels so awful. Why is that the association? That I feel really bad about that. Let's go back.
Scottie Pippen.
Versatile. I think as you had mentioned earlier, that felt...
He did. He got caught with a gun in his car.
You know what, though? All right. So for my my research for this book, I read a bunch of books, and Melissa Isaacson had a great book that I had never heard of called Transition Game that she published after the 94 season. So, you know, with no hindsight. And Jordan had a gun in the locker room.
Oh, so it was
like not even reported. Like, I don't understand.
He gets caught because, he probably gun in the locker room is caught by the Bulls security.
Exactly.
a police officer caught Pippen.
Pippen got caught by a police officer, absolutely. Right. But just that it wasn't discussed.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan. Gun.
All right, so you say six life lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
So let's go through them. So number one, you say, if your head approves, follow your heart.
Yeah. So Michael was talking about retirement as early as 91. He had always been intrigued by baseball. And I think that the ultimate difference between Jordan and Kobe, who everybody compares, is that Kobe's passion is basketball. That's his obsession. And Michael's obsession is winning.
Right.
And he needed the competition. He needed the challenge.
He's getting sick of just winning in the NBA.
And he was. He was. And he left. And as soon as he did, like, the whole time that he was gone, he was calling B.J. Armstrong. He was calling Joe Dumars and saying, hey, what's up with these new guys? What's up with this Penny? Is he good? How good is he? Like, Sprewell? What's up with him? Is Chris Webber? Like, he always wanted to know what was next. And for him, you've won three straight. You've toppled Larry, Magic, Isaiah, Charles Barkley, Clyde Drexler, like all of his peers he's eclipsed. So he needed to go. He needed to step away. And as we saw with Jordan's career, he stepped away again and he came back. I think that he could not maintain the fire because he was dominant. Now, maybe that's a weakness. Maybe that's a flaw in his career. Yeah. However you want to view it, you view it. But that was the truth.
All right, we got a couple minutes left here. Lesson two, don't be afraid to push your limits.
Yeah, that was Scottie Pippen. When Michael left, Scottie felt like, yes. Like he announced to nobody in the locker room in October, Michael, I love you, but I'm glad to see you go. Like, I'm not going to miss you. Like, Scottie wanted to go out there and do it. And then he had that frustration and that unfortunate, you know, incident at the end of the year with the 1.8 seconds, which his teammates all forgave him for really fast. It was really the fans and the media that didn't. Like, his teammates and his coaches.
You know, we wanted Pippen so bad to almost not be Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like, it was like we couldn't accept that Michael was gone and Pippen was... It's just, even though we all were very loyal to Scottie Pippen, it just wasn't
We didn't
Michael.
Want anyone to be right. Michael. We didn't want the next generation. We didn't want Grant Hill and Penny Hardaway to be Michael. So Scottie pushed himself, but the rest of that lesson is to be comfortable within your space and within your skills, and that's what Scottie also did.
Let's do lesson three. Surround yourself with humble talent for a unified mission.
Yeah, that first three-peat, everybody had grown up together. So they all kind of felt like they had done it together, which they had, but that also drove more jealousy.
Okay.
And the second three-peat didn't have that. They all just wanted to win and to prove themselves.
Lesson four, think creatively about your shortcomings.
Yeah, this was the Bulls and the Warriors, the tie-in between them. The Bulls looked at their defeat to Orlando, and they wanted big guards because they'd been beaten by big guards. And so that's when they started to figure out, listen, we're going to have our small forward bring the ball up. We're going to have our shooting guard score in the post. We're going to have this flexible, malleable lineup with Kukoc at center, kind of, or Rodman kind of at center. I mean,
Rodman
ahead.
Shaquille O'Neal on one-on-one in that series.
Right, exactly.
Lesson five, don't panic. That bad break today might be the luck you need tomorrow.
Yeah, so this is the most fun and most convoluted chapter of the book, which is how the Trailblazers signing Chris Dudley in 1993 led to the Bulls getting Bill Wennington, Ron Harper, and kind of Dennis Rodman. And it ends up in federal court, and I won't go into it now. But The Bulls lost Horace Grant in 94, and this figures into this. They considered him the first free agent that they ever wanted to re-sign and couldn't, and it was a big disaster.
That seems to still haunt them today.
And it ended up with them having Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, well, they won in that case.
Right.
Lesson six, find a coach who will help you be your best self.
Yeah, Michael Jordan was 30 minutes away from signing with the New York Knicks in 1996. His contract expired, and the Knicks put this great offer on the table, and David Falk called Jerry Reinsdorf and said, here's the deal. This is real. This is happening. Show us the money. We're out. But Michael's one concern was that he didn't know if he could play for Jeff Van Gundy or, frankly, any other coach. He said, Phil Jackson, that's my coach. I know him. I trust him. I love him. And Phil's fingerprints are all over the success of that team. He helped everybody be their best self.
Well, it's fascinating and a great appropriate topic with the Golden State Warriors playing in game five tonight. And they're winning, I believe, a commercial, but they're winning by about 9 with about 8 to go in the fourth quarter. They're not the GOAT.
No.
The GOAT in the Chicago Bulls, the 96 Chicago Bulls. How the GOAT was built, 6 life lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls, the author Jack Silverstein. Jack, thanks for being here, man.
Hey, thank you, Justin.